All right, so howdy, everybody. I'm Alex Wills, as some of you know. And if for any reason you want to reach me with, sort of outside of these lectures with questions or anything like that, you probably got my email address with sort of the announcement about this short course, but just in case not, you can reach me at wills@susqu.edu, like that. And howdy, howdy. And for those just arriving, let me mention again that there's a sheet coming around on which I'm gathering email addresses. And the reason for that is that I'm going to distribute notes for this course through Dropbox, and so I need your address to add you to the Dropbox. Okay? So, all right. So what are we all doing here today? We've come here today, as I understand it, to learn about GPTs, right? And so I think a reasonable thing to do at the outset is to ask, what does that stand for? What are these mysterious GPTs? Well, the acronym originally was proposed by John Barrett and stands for, or stood for, Generalized Probabilistic Theories. That's both a bit of a mouthful and also, in some ways, in my view, misleading. First of all, I don't really like this suffix here, generalized from what, right? It doesn't really do a lot of work here. So I think we could safely get rid of that. And in fact, a lot of people do call the objects that we're going to be studying general probabilistic theories. But I think we can go a little bit further. In my view, what this subject is about is general probability theory. And the object of study in general probability theory is what we're going to call probabilistic models, in a sense that's slightly, conservatively, more general than the probabilistic models that you would encounter in a standard probability theory course. And we will also study sort of coherent collections of probabilistic models that sort of band together to form what you might call a probabilistic theory. So probabilistic theories will be one of the objects of study, but really what we're talking about is a generalization of classical probability theory. And as I already hinted a moment ago, it's a fairly conservative one, conceptually and in some sense technically, and yet its scope is surprisingly vast. And in spite of the rapid growth of interest in this subject over the last maybe 15 to 20 years, there's still a great deal we don't know. It's not very well explored subject. So what I'd like to do over the next, well, I guess we have technically 7 lectures scheduled. What I'd like to do in that time is to cover at least the following 4 topics, and then if we have some time at the end, we can talk about other things as well. But I think minimally, we need to talk about the concept of a probabilistic model. And I hope to get through as much of that as I can today. And then we're going to need to talk about how you take the concept of a probabilistic model and linearize it, how you turn a theory that a priori has nothing much to do with vector spaces and linear transformations and so on, and how you recast it as a theory in that kind of a linear framework. So we'll talk about probabilistic models linearized. Maybe that will be what we do on Thursday. Then we're going to need to talk about how you combine probabilistic models in something like the manner of a tensor product in quantum theory, how you describe composite systems or coupled systems. So we'll talk about composite systems, or composite models, maybe we should say. And with that, we'll talk about entanglement as it manifests itself in this framework. And then finally, we're going to have to talk about probabilistic theories per se. And that's going to involve a certain amount of category theory. So what I'll propose to do is work in a sort of a short crash course in the fairly small amount of category theory that we'll need in order to sketch what I have in mind, but we'll need a little bit there. And then, you know, let's just leave it a little vague at the moment what we will do after that, if there is an after that. Okay, if we have time left over, there are other things we can discuss. And I'll be guided by, you know, your suggestions and your interests. But, you know, we could talk about, ontic models. We could talk about contextuality. We could talk about lots of things. Okay, so good. Let me just start with a tiny bit of history before we dive in and talk about probabilistic models. There's a sense in which this is a pretty new topic, a new subject. The current interest in GPTs was really sparked by, originally by a wonderful paper by Lucian, who's sitting back there, Lucian Hardy, whose name I can't spell. And that was from 2000. And shortly after that, John Barrett, I think, Lucian, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think this is around 2004. Yeah, 2004 or 5. I think on the archive maybe 2004, but I'm not 100% sure. Published a paper entitled something like Information Processing in Generalized Probabilistic Theories, giving us our subject a good name. And that sparked a lot of additional interest. And then after that, there was kind of an explosion of work where all kinds of things got done. In particular, right after this, it was shown that a lot of signature features of quantum information processing, like the no broadcasting theorem, teleportation, entanglement, swapping, all of these sorts of things, actually worked in a vastly more general setting. You didn't really need quantum mechanics, you just needed to stay away from classical probability theory, and all of these things suddenly appear on the stage. So it's a new subject, rapid development since 2000 or 2005, especially. Another thing that has happened, starting with Lucian's paper, which was about this very subject, is that there's been a plethora of reconstructions of quantum mechanics from various packages of relatively simple axioms governing some sort of general probabilistic theory or certain classes of probabilistic models. That's another topic we could discuss. All right, so it's a new subject. It's also an extremely old subject. In retrospect, we can see that a lot of von Neumann's work, especially in his 1937 book and in his paper with Birkhoff the same year, was devoted to looking at quantum mechanics from the perspective of something like a general probabilistic theory, although he didn't really outline what the general framework should look like. The person who first did that was a guy named George Mackey, who published a paper in 1957 and then a slightly expanded version of that as a short book in, I think, 63. Von Neumann's book and Mackey's book have exactly the same title, The Mathematical Foundations of Quantum Mechanics. But Mackey very explicitly sets up a framework for something like a general probability theory that would not necessarily be classical, and then tries to narrow that down, constrain that with various axioms so that you could single out quantum mechanics, and also to study quantum mechanics from that point of view. Mackey's work in particular, and also von Neumann's in a slightly different way, led to a big explosion of work, especially in the mathematics community, not as well known perhaps in the physics community, but anyway, there was this vast explosion of work on what came to be called quantum logic, or maybe better to say quantum logics, because it was an investigation of various ordered algebraic structures that arise from axioms like Mackey's, but then can be studied autonomously, just as mathematical objects. And so a whole theory of that sort developed, I would say, in the 60s through maybe the early 1980s. And then at that point, I think it's fair to say that interest sort of waned a little bit in that whole way of looking at quantum mechanics and the whole project of trying to understand quantum mechanics from that point of view. And what happened was that, what happened was quantum information theory. And quantum information theory caused people, at least quantum information theorists, to start asking themselves some of the same kinds of questions that people back in this earlier era had asked themselves, to get interested in foundational questions. And in particular, one of them, a guy named Chris Fuchs, some of you might have heard of in connection with something called quantum Bayesianism, he wrote a very interesting, very provocative paper where he laid a lot of those questions out and said, you know, look, we've got quantum mechanics, and it's got this very elaborate mathematical structure involving Hilbert spaces and this weird way of assigning probabilities to things. And who ordered that? Where does that really come from? Can we motivate that in some principled way? And as I understand it, and Lucian, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think I've heard you say that it was that paper of Chris's that sort of prompted you to write your five axioms paper?
That's right. Several exactly gave talks.
Oh, okay.
A little bit later.
Okay, but okay. So Chris was agitating.
He was completely instrumental in me doing that, and a parallel branch due to Jeff Booth and
right.
Alison and Rob Fifty.
Yes, yes, and they were also motivated by issues in quantum information theory. So that's a pocket history of the subject. There's this sort of prehistory, and then a period of quiescence, and then, you know, quantum information theory comes along and it sparks renewed interest. However, a lot of the work that was done in this sort of newer era initially was done, I think, without a huge amount of input from the older literature, which remained, you know, a little bit off the radar, perhaps understandably, because the newer stuff was mostly the work of physicists interested in quantum information theory. The older stuff had mostly been developed by pure mathematicians, you know, publishing in the pure math journals and so on. So not surprisingly, there's a bit of a gap. One of the things that I've been trying to do is bridge that a little bit. And so the particular framework that I'm going to sketch for you is one that draws on some of this earlier work, in particular on work from two people who were working in sort of this idiom by the name of D.J. Faulis and his collaborator, a man named Charlie Randall. And they came up with a framework that I think actually is particularly flexible and has a number of other advantages as well, not least that it's very elementary, at least to start with. It starts with almost nothing and builds a lot out of that, nearly nothing. And fair disclosure, Faulis was my PhD supervisor. So, you know, to some extent, I've inherited this stuff. All right. So let me, before we dive in and I tell you what a probabilistic model is, not that I've used up 20 minutes of my time, let me just pause and ask if there are any questions before we get started in earnest. All right, shall I tell you what a probabilistic model is? Okay. Okay, I'm told if I raise this too high, the camera there will not be able to see you guys anymore. Is that a problem? It's fine? Okay. Okay, that's fine. Okay. All right, so let's talk about probabilistic models. So let me just start by reminding you of what that term, probabilistic model, means in elementary probability theory. Elementary classical probability theory. It's a term that's used a lot, in fact. And what is meant by a probabilistic model in elementary classical probability theory is essentially a single probability weight on some outcome space or sample space. So mathematically, that means that you have a pair consisting of a set, capital E, which I will call the outcome set. Or you could say sample space, but outcome set seems more descriptive. And then a probability weight, which I'll call alpha, little alpha. And so what is little alpha? Alpha is just a function from the outcomes to the real numbers. And it's got to be non-negative. I don't know if everybody can see if I'm writing. Can you guys see if I write down here? Is that all right? All right. It's got to be non-negative, and it has to sum to 1 over all the outcome, all the x's. So sum over little x in E of alpha of x is 1. All right. So alpha of x is the probability of outcome little x, and the sum of the probabilities is 1, and that's it. Full stop. All right. That's a probabilistic model. As far as discrete, elementary, discrete classical probability theory is concerned. Now, looking at that, even knowing nothing about quantum mechanics, just from a mathematical point of view, there's a very, very obvious generalization that almost cries out to be made. Why just one? For that matter, why just one of these? The obvious generalization is to let E and alpha vary. Right? That's all. Just, you know, consider a bunch of outcome sets, maybe for a bunch of experiments, and consider a bunch of probability weights. All right, so let's try to make that maybe a little more precise. There's one way to do that. Definition: a test space, or actually in the older literature, and I think this was a better term, or manual, as in like manual of experiments, a test space or manual is just a collection, a set, say scriptm, of outcome sets. In other words, it's just a collection of sets, each of which you interpret as the outcome set of some experiment or some other operation that you could perform that has outcomes. If we let big X stand for the union of scriptm, in other words, just throw all the outcomes of all the experiments into one big pot and call that capital X, then a probability weight on this test space is a function, I'll call it alpha, from this sort of total outcome space, X, to the reals. It assigns a probability to every outcome. Alpha X has to be greater than or equal to 0 for every X. For every outcome of every experiment, the probability is not negative. And the sum of the probabilities over the outcomes of an experiment has to be 1. And this must be true for every experiment, or as one sometimes says, test, in the collection script A. And that last quantifier, of course, is sort of the crucial thing. And that's basically the framework. I'm going to refine this and add a little structure to it, but that's the basic idea right there. Generalize classical probability theory by allowing multiple experiments. And notice a key thing. The way I've defined probability weights, they only depend upon outcomes. They don't depend upon the choice of experiment. Now, in many cases, that doesn't matter because the experiments are all, you know, unrelated, disjoint sets. But should it occur that two of these outcome sets share an outcome, that they overlap, if there's an outcome that could be achieved by performing experiment E or could be achieved also by performing experiment F, we're not letting the probabilities depend upon which of those we used. Now, the term of art for that sort of independence from the larger experimental context of the probability of an outcome is non-contextuality. So our probability weights are non-contextual by definition. And later, if somebody reminds me to do it, I'll show you why that's not a problem, if that worries you. All right, so having told you what my analog of that setup is, let me suggest that sometimes we might not be interested in absolutely arbitrary probability weights on our test space. We might have, for modeling purposes, some constrained set of probability weights that we want to focus on. A probabilistic model is for me a pair consisting of a test space and some designated set of probability weights. So M is the test space. Omega is a subset, a designated subset, of the set of all probability weights, which I'm going to write as PR of M. So I might be interested in just a single probability weight, in which case big omega is just a singleton set with one entry. I might be interested in all the probability weights, in which case omega would be all of PR of M. In that case, I'm going to say the model is full, no restrictions on the probability weights. Big M, you know, might consist of just a single outcome set, in which case we're sort of back in this context if we restrict omega to be a singleton as well. But we have a lot more freedom to maneuver in this setting. Okay. Now, before we do anything else, probably it would be reasonable to see a couple of examples, right? Later I'm going to tell you that quantum mechanics is an example, but we'll come back to that. Let's look at some very simple examples. So, I guess I can put that up there. Am I going too fast, by the way, at all? Everybody okay so far? All right. So I can put this up here. I don't have to worry that it will disappear, that people won't be able to see the top of the board. They were still furiously scribbling. No, okay. All right, so here's a very simple example. Let's just call this example one. Let's suppose that you have a test space that consists of exactly two experiments or two tests. One has only two outcomes, which I will call X and X prime. I'm going to call that experiment E just for reference. And the other experiment is similar. It consists of just two outcomes, which I will call Y and Y prime. Call that F. If you want to be very concrete about it, you could say, well, maybe I've got, you know, two coins, you know, a quarter and, you know, a loonie or something like that. Since we're in Canada, I can say that. And I only get to flip one of them. I'm not allowed to flip them both, right? Like maybe somebody's holding, you know, the coins for me and will only give me one of them. I have to choose. And then I get to flip it and see whether I get heads or tails, right? So let me draw a little picture of this in a style that I'm going to use again. So I might as well introduce it here. If you have a test space that has only a few tests and they only have a few outcomes each, then it's usually possible to represent it by means of what's called a Grigy diagram, which consists of a bunch of nodes that represent the outcomes, and then nodes that belong to a single test are connected by some sort of a thread, some sort of a line. In some cases, you might need, you know, lines that aren't straight. You might need smooth curves of some sort. You just make sure that the curves intersect, if they do, at enough of an angle that you can tell, you know, what lies on what curve. But in this case, the outcome sets are disjoint. There's no overlap, so it's very straightforward. Okay, so if we think about what's a probability weight, well, it's going to assign values between 0 and 1 to x and x prime, and those values sum to 1, so that means that alpha of x prime, if alpha is my probability weight, is 1 minus alpha of x, and similarly, alpha of y prime is 1 minus alpha of y, and that means that the probability weight is completely determined as soon as I know the probability of x and the probability of y, so the probability weight alpha is effectively determined by the pair alpha of x, alpha of y, which is just a point in R2 consisting of two numbers between 0 and 1, and they can be anywhere between 0 and 1, right? Because there are no further constraints, and so the full space of probability weights just amounts to the unit square. That's already significant because if you look at the space of probability weights on any classical test space, by which I mean a test space with just one test, just one experiment, you get a simplex. You get a convex set that is either, you say, in two dimensions a triangle, in three dimensions a tetrahedron, yes, like that on up the dimensional line. This isn't a simplex, so that will turn out to be very important later on. Okay, let me pause again just for a moment. Quick questions? No? Everybody's happy so far? Okay. For those of you who've, you know, brushed up against the literature, you'll recognize that this is one half of a so-called PR box. Although my notation, I apologize to those of you who like such things because my notation is almost backwards, right? I'm using capital letters for the tests and little letters for the outcomes and the PR box, people like to do it the other way around, which makes me crazy, but so now it's my turn. I'm having my revenge. Okay, all right, so that was an example. Let's look at another example that's somewhat similar to that. The reason I'm wandering around looking distraught and puzzled is that I'm looking for this eraser, which I had moved out of the line of sight. Okay. All right, so here comes example two. Let's suppose that we have a test space whose Grici diagram looks like this. This is one test, this is another. Each of these tests has three outcomes, and they share an outcome. Let me label these a little bit, okay? Let's call this U, V, W, and maybe X and Y like that. So the test space that's pictured here with those labelings is the set consisting of the set U, X, V, and the set consisting of V, Y, W. Right? So there are two experiments. You get to choose one and perform it. Each one has three outcomes. One of the outcomes is shared. Could be achieved by performing E, could be achieved by performing F. Okay? So far, so good? All right, so let's think about what probability weights look like on this thing. Well, notice that alpha of X is 1 minus alpha of U plus alpha of V. And similarly for alpha of Y, except now it's 1 minus alpha of W plus alpha of V. So it seems that these three numbers, alpha of U, alpha of V, and alpha of W, completely determine the probability weight. All right. Are they completely sort of independent? Can we choose any number between 0 and 1 for, say, alpha of U? Well, I think so. So for example, if I choose 1 here, that means these two have to get probability 0. And I still have plenty of room to pick probabilities here that will make everything add up to 1. And if I pick probability 0 here, well, there's even more room. I just need to make the numbers add up to 1. That's easy, right? What about down here at V? Oh, same for W. Down here at V, if I make that 1, well, then I'm done. Because now I have to say the probabilities here, 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 and here are all 0. But that's a perfectly good probability weight because it does add up to 1 over these outcomes and over these outcomes. So far, so good? Go ahead, Ian.
Can you say that it's still 2 cases, though, if you're going to hold one probability, which is non-zero? Can you still say there's an E and an F?
Yes.
Identical?
Oh, I see. Yes, because this is only the probability of seeing V. I mean, I sort of see what you mean. You know, if that were the metaphysically true probability that no matter what I did, I was bound to see this outcome V, I was just being delusional and thinking that there were these other outcomes. Yeah, maybe. But that doesn't prevent us from considering, you know, delusional situations. Probability theory is perfectly happy to entertain, you know, your delusions and to tell you how you should think about them rationally. Yes? Okay. So, bottom line, yeah. Alpha of U, alpha of V, and alpha of W could be any numbers between 0 and 1, but, well, not quite, because, for example, alpha of W plus alpha of V still has to be less than or equal to 1. And alpha of U plus alpha of V also has to be less than or equal to 1. So I'll leave the rest as sort of an exercise for you, but I believe what you get when you plot the probability weights as functions of, say, U, V, and W is a kind of skewed pyramid that looks like this in the XY plane. It's a square-based pyramid, but with a vertex shifted over here to the V axis. All right? All right, fair enough?
That front left corner, that should pick the vertex.
This one here? This was meant to, yeah, so this is...
That line that comes down from the top, from V to that corner, should it hit that corner or just be slightly off the corner?
Let me see. It's meant to be a square-based pyramid, so I do need a line here. Yeah, so I think that's right. And that's fine, because this is just the point where U and W are both one, and that's a perfectly good probability weight, right? 1, 0, 0, 0, 1 adds up to 1 over both sides. So I think that's okay.
What is W?
What is that again?
There are two V's in that.
Oh, there are two V's? No. I just erased something, I suppose. That's a W. Okay. All right? All right, so just try to convince yourself that that's correct. All right, so it's quite fun to play with these things, and we'll come back and maybe, if there's time, see one more in this style. Let me make a couple of remarks, and then we'll return to examples, including some slightly more sophisticated, less factitious examples. So first remark is that if you have two tests in your test space, and one is contained in the other, meaning all the outcomes of E are also outcomes of F, then if you have an outcome Y in F take away E, if there were some outcome in Y that wasn't an outcome in E, its probability would have to be 0 for all probability weights. Let me just pause for a moment. Does everybody see that? Right? The probabilities are non-negative. They add up to 1 over every test. So they already add up to 1 over E. And so if there's anything spilling outside of E in F, those had better get probability 0, or I'll end up with a probability that's greater than 1. So for this reason, for the reason that such sort of extra outcomes would never ever occur, we don't allow them. We assume, therefore, that script A is irredundant meaning that that if E is contained in F, then in fact E equals F. There are no proper inclusions among the tests or the experiments in your collection. Okay? Second observation. If you look at the collection of all probability weights on a test space, this is always convex as a subset of the set of all functions on the outcomes, taking real values. If I take a weighted average of two probability weights, that's of course still going to add up to 1 over all the tests, and so it's still a probability weight. For this reason, if we decide to privilege some probability weights and say that those are maybe the states of our model, we could take the convex hull, the convex closure of that set, and maybe allow elements of that to serve as models of randomized mixtures of our allowed states. And so for that reason, it is usual to assume for any probabilistic model M omega that omega is convex. And I will assume that unless I say otherwise, it is, okay? So it'll be a standing assumption that we might occasionally suspend, but for now we'll keep it in force. Okay. Let me show you another example. Question, maybe? Just okay. I'm always on the hunt for furrowed brows and puzzled expressions. Let me show you another example to allay a very reasonable fear that might be percolating in some brains right now. And that is the fear that what we're doing is not really generalizing probability theory, we're only generalizing discrete probability theory. Of course, probability theory takes place against a measure theoretic background in which the usual object of study, or at least the basis on which probability measures are defined, is what's called a measurable space. I guess this will be example three. So let's let S sigma be a measurable space. And here I should pause to ask just quickly so that I know, show of hands, how many people here have seen any measure theory at all? Like, know what this means? Okay, so almost nobody? Okay, so what is this? Okay, in the framework for probability theory due to Kolmogorov, which is still quite standard, one uses what are called measurable spaces. S is a set, and sigma is a so-called sigma Boolean algebra of subsets of S called the events in a probabilistic context. And then, well, I guess I should pause here again to say Boolean algebra, I'm going to assume everybody kind of knows what that means. Sigma Boolean just means that you can take countable unions instead of just finite unions of subsets in sigma. Shall I write this down? Do people want to know what this means? Okay, so what does this mean? This means that if you have sets, let's say A1 through, A1, A2, et cetera, in sigma, then A1 union, et cetera, well, let's write it like this, then the union as I goes from 1 to infinity of A sub I is in sigma. You need the empty set and all of sigma to be in, pardon me, not all of sigma, all of S to be in sigma, and you need the collection to be closed under taken complements. So if little a is a set in sigma, then little a complement, in other words, S take away little a, is in sigma. So you've got this big collection of sets that are the so-called measurable sets, also called the events, and then a probability measure on this is a function mu from sigma to the reals, and the condition is that if you have a bunch of sets A sub I that are pairwise disjoint, then the sum of mu of AI as I goes from 1 to infinity is the measure of, or the probability of, the union of those sets. And to make it a probability measure, you also require that it assign non-negative values and that the value assigned to the entire set S is 1. So that's a super condensed introduction to the Kolmogorov, or the measure theoretic framework for classical probability theory. So far I haven't provided you with anything that looks anything like this, right? This is seemingly a little bit at a remove from these discrete test spaces. However, the concept of a test space is quite broad, and it actually accommodates that very easily and in a nice way. So, example continued. Given my measurable space, I'm going to define a test space, script M, built out of the measurable space, and maybe it's script M of S and sigma, as follows. It's going to consist of all countable partitions of S by sets belonging to sigma. Indeed, if you look at the way in which classical probability theory in this measure theoretic idiom gets used, when you have to translate this framework or extract from this framework a story about some particular experiment that you might want to do in the lab, which might have only finitely many or perhaps at most countably many outcomes, that experiment is taken to be a partition of this set S by sets in this algebra of events. In other words, you've got a large collection of mutually exclusive alternatives. They're disjoint, so they're mutually exclusive. And they union up to the full set S, which is sort of the set of all the possibilities. That's an experiment. But nothing prohibits us from just abstracting, throwing away the sigma algebra structure and just saying, well, we've got this collection of countable partitions. That's our test space. And if you do that, then exercise for those of you who've seen measure theory, the probability weights on that test space turn out to be exactly the probability measures on S sigma. So you didn't really need the Boolean algebra structure except to give you this collection of this particular collection of experiments. So So in fact, classical Kolmogorovian measure theoretic probability theory fits into this framework in a relatively straightforward way. Okay, let me show you now another example, the one you've been waiting for. What about quantum mechanics? How does quantum theory fit into this framework? Again, fairly easily. As follows. So this is going to be example, what are we up to? Example five? Four. Example four. Let H be a Hilbert space. And by the way, not necessarily finite dimensional. Any Hilbert space. Any Hilbert space. The corresponding frame test space, or in my day it was called the frame manual, so I'm going to call it that, is script F of H, and it simply consists of all of the maximal pairwise orthogonal sets of unit vectors. So it's the set of all subsets of H that are pairwise orthogonal, consist of unit vectors, and basically that's to say they're orthonormal bases. So, E is an orthonormal basis for the Hilbert space. It's an orthonormal basis, but it's not ordered necessarily, it's just a set. Okay, is that all right with everybody? Okay. Great. Those are one way in which one sometimes models quantum mechanical experiments, at least ones that are sort of maximally informative, right? You say they've got this outcome vector, that outcome vector, and so on. So we'll just take that literally and say that's our test space. And now we can ask, what are the probability weights? Well, if V is a unit vector, then we can define a function alpha sub V of X, where X is also a unit vector, to be, but thought of now as an outcome, to be the squared modulus of the inner product of, sorry, of V with X, like that. And just by the usual formula expressing the norm of a vector as the square root of the sum of the squares of the components, which works in any Hilbert space, that's a probability weight, because V is a unit vector. A little bit more generally, if you have a density operator, I'm going to want to call my operators by capital letters rather than Greek letters, so I'm not going to call it rho, I'm going to call it W. So if W is a density operator on H, then we could also define alpha sub W of unit vector X qua outcome to be the inner product of W applied to X with X, which is the same thing as the trace of W times the projection associated with X, if you prefer that way of writing it. Anyway, that's also a probability weight. In fact, in a certain sense, probability weights of this kind are just countable convex combinations of probability weights of the first kind. Okay, well, great. So we have a lot of probability weights, and they're just the usual things we encounter in quantum theory. And I guess we could stop there. We could say a quantum model consists of this test space and these probability weights. But we might still want to ask the question, at least if we're wearing our mathematician hats, are there any others? Maybe there are some other things out there that, you know, some other consistent ways of assigning probabilities to these outcomes. So I guess we can ask that question. Question: are there others? Are there any more? The answer is really cool. If the dimension of H is at least 3, then the answer is no. There are no others. All probability weights have this form, this second form up here, they all arise from density operators. This is a very celebrated theorem that a lot of you will know about, but perhaps not everybody. It's due to Andrew Gleason, published in 1957. Nowadays just known as Gleason's theorem. It's very non-trivial. It's not easy to prove, even today. And it also, as we'll maybe talk about later, generalizes quite a lot as well. Of course, this does come with a little restriction. But, oh, well, okay, dimension 2, right? Who cares about dimension 2? Who cares about quantum systems with a measly dimension of 2? Apart from everybody, right? Okay, those are qubits. We would like to be able to say something about qubits. So for qubits, you take your quantum model to be the frame manual, or there are some other things you could use here, but something like it. And you have to explicitly by hand put in the density matrices or the probability weights coming from the density matrices as your state space, because the qubit actually admits lots and lots of other ugly, very unphysical states as well. Okay? But as soon as you're dealing with, you know, like spin one particles or higher, or anything infinite dimensional, you don't need that extra constraint. All right, I'm almost out of time, and I've covered about half of what I had written down, which is actually very much my way. I always do this. I always get too ambitious. So next time I will finish what I had wanted to do today, and I'll sort of finish the story of probabilistic models. And the two main things on that agenda are, first, I want to tell you a little bit about how you manipulate what are called events in this framework. Events are subsets of tests that represent maybe sort of coarse-grained outcomes. There's a great deal to say there that's pretty interesting. And I also want to tell you how you handle sequential measurements, how given a stock of experiments or measurements, you can synthesize models of multi-stage branching experiments in which you might, for instance, do a first experiment and then, depending upon the outcome of that, do a second experiment that might depend on what you saw at the first stage and maybe keep going. And in fact, I'll show you a construction whereby you can sort of close up under the possibility of performing these branching multi-stage experiments of any length, any number of stages. And that turns out to be a pretty interesting gadget. If that somehow, by magic, takes less than an hour, then I'll get a start on how you linearize all of this. And otherwise, that can wait for next week. Okay, we have a couple of minutes. Any questions for me before we stop? So, yes?
In example four, we're not including measurement results that are like degenerate, let's say.
Yeah, and that's what I'll come to next time. That's what I meant about these sort of coarse-grained things. Yeah. So this is only one possible quantum model, and it only allows these sort of maximally informative, totally non-degenerate experiments. But we can make a sort of a richer model that allows for the degenerate things too, and we want to. Okay. All right. So I'm going to stick around for a few minutes, but you know, if people have places to be, don't.
What breaks in the proof, and what goes wrong and does not work?
In dimension two.
Yeah. Is there any physical limitation?
Yeah, I'll tell you what goes wrong. It's really sort of dramatic. In dimension two, suppose I have, actually, Gleason's theorem, I want to say, it works not only for complex Hilbert spaces, but also real ones, even quaternionic ones. You know, it's very general. The problem in dimension two is the same problem regardless of the field or the division ring. It's that in two dimensions, if I have an, or let me just illustrate this in the real case. If I have an orthonormal basis, maybe it looks like this. Okay. What are the other possible orthonormal bases? Well, there's one case that's not very interesting where I just maybe reverse one or both vectors. But it's not very hard to show that the probability attached to this outcome and this outcome are the same in all states. Probability for this and this are the same in all states. So actually using unit vectors in a way is redundant. I should probably use one-dimensional subspaces as my outcomes. So let's just pretend that we're doing that. Okay, so you know that's sort of the next step in making this a little bit nicer. Well, now what are the other orthonormal bases? Well, the only other thing I can do here is rotate. So if I rotate, I get, I knew there was colored chalk here somewhere, right? Yes, okay. So if I rotate that slightly, I get maybe this. And now, what do you notice about the, you know, the sort of interesting combinatorial structure here?
Alex.
Yeah, they're waiting. I have to go. So, but just to finish this, it's not interesting. These don't overlap. There's no intersections. Distinct projective orthonormal bases are disjoint in two dimensions, which means there are no constraints at all on how you assign the probabilities. Right? I could, you know, just choose a different probability for each orthonormal basis any way you want. It's just, you know, absurdly unconstrained. Okay, that's what goes wrong. So, all right, thank you all.